Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me from Maryland is Greg. Greg, we're going to talk now a little bit about the situation in Ukraine. It's been a couple weeks at least, I think, since we talked about Ukraine. Why don't you fill us in on what's been going on there in the last week?
Well, so, you know, by the time this comes out, things may have changed since we've recorded it. But basically, what's been going on in the last week is that there's been a lot of unrest in the eastern parts of Ukraine with pro-Russian separatists who are trying to force the Ukrainian government basically to allow their separation from Ukraine and incorporation into Russia are clashing with the Ukrainian government. There's been a lot of violence. People have died. There's been denials about who is involved with what. I recall there was something last week where there was a letter circulated to all of the Jews that stipulated that they were going to have to register all of their possessions needed to be accounted for as well, and that if they did not register within a certain time frame, that they could be basically removed from their homes. So this turned out to be a fake letter, but one that was distributed. It's not very clear if it was distributed by pro-Russian separatists or by Ukrainian nationalists. No one is taking credit for it. It's been sort of problematic in that this is 2014 and we're not really supposed to be telling Jews that they need to go register places because it's very Holocaust-esque. These are sort of the things that have been happening in eastern Ukraine for the last week. It's basically just been a powder keg right now. Things are moving very, very rapidly. So by the time Wednesday rolls around and we're on the radio at 6 o'clock, there may be something else that's happened.
Now, one of the big developments, of course, over the weekend was that in addition to the Ukrainian armed forces moving on the city of Slovyansk in the Donetsk Oblast, which is sort of a region, but more like a U.S. state, I guess. It's a little bit complicated to try to convert the terms into U.S. terms. But in the Donetsk region, this city of Slovyansk was a particular problem in the Ukrainian government decided, I guess, that it was small enough that they were going to try to take it back because they said the interim government said that they had lost effective control of the Donbas Basin, which is two of the oblasts, including Donetsk, that are right on the far eastern part of the country. And this, as Greg said, has led to fatalities. But then in addition to this situation in Slovyansk, there were clashes that broke out in Odessa. Now, Odessa is a major port city. It's on the Black Sea coast. It's over right near Moldova, the neighboring country of Moldova, also a former Soviet republic. It's sort of probably, I think, the biggest city between Crimea and Moldova. And a couple weeks back, Odessa, which is almost the most Ukrainian possible city you can think of, short of Kiev itself, right? If you're from the Western perspective anyway, if you're trying to think of what's a city in Ukraine, you're going to say Kiev, and then you're going to say Odessa. And Vladimir Putin a few weeks ago in April saying in passing in a town hall speech, saying that, you know, Odessa is historically Russian. And then he used the term Novorossiya, which is Russian for New Russia, which is a term that was applied obviously by Russia, but specifically Imperial Russia when it was the Russian Empire in the period from the 18th century to the 1917 Russian Revolution. That is obviously not a great way to be referring to a large chunk of Ukraine, especially because it's a very, very large stretch that effectively goes all the way from Donetsk to Odessa, and that would provide an overland route to Crimea. We had talked about, right after Crimea was taken, essentially, even before the annexation officially had gone through, we had talked about the problem that Russia is going to have with holding on to Crimea as it currently stands by itself. Crimea, both in the Soviet era and in the post-Soviet Ukraine era, was predominantly served by the Ukrainian mainland to the peninsula. Everything is set up to deliver resources and supplies and have economic trade, and everything is set up to go to the mainland. Now they're not allowed to access the mainland, and everything has to come through Russia, which is not connected to Crimea, and this bridge is being proposed. They're saying, oh, we're going to build this huge multi-billion dollar bridge. That's not going to go up for another several years, so that's a nightmare situation for the local economy in the meantime. Worse than that, it would be basically middle of nowhere Russia. It's too far away from Sochi, which isn't that big anyway. and it's too far away from everything else. So they have to now send everything from way out in Moscow all the way down to the middle of nowhere in the Circassian region, and then put it on this little ferry that goes across to Crimea, and that's just inefficient. So they're saying, oh, wait, what if we just take back the area that it was connected to on the Ukrainian mainland? When Putin starts talking about Novorossiya, that's the region, that's the whole Sea of Azov, Black Sea coast that goes all the way, as I said, from Russia proper across just north of Crimea, all the way to Odessa and to Moldova. And it will allow them to link back up with the Transnistria breakaway region, which tried to declare independence in about, what, 92-ish? Well, the multiple phase declaration of independence in the 1990s. And a large Russian Soviet division was stationed there at the time as the Soviet Union was breaking up, and essentially just remained in place and helped this region break off by default from Moldova. And they've just been kind of operating on their own. They're not part of Russia. But after the Crimea takeover, they started saying, oh, hey, maybe we should actually formally join Russia. And Russia still has troops there as so-called peacekeepers, although it's much smaller now than it used to be. They had to pull a lot of troops out to go beat up Chechnya. The idea is that if they take back Novorossiya, that whole region, that clears Russia a path all the way to Transnistria through Odessa and supplies Crimea. That's sort of the kind of ideal world scenario for the ultra-expansionist faction in Russia. We don't know how firmly Putin is in that faction, but he's the top dog, and he's the one mentioning it in speeches. So to me, it sounds like that's what's happening next, which makes the clashes in Odessa of particular significance. It's a little bit hard to tell what actually happened there. Initially, it seemed that the police were involved in attacking pro-Russia protesters. Now that seems to have not been the case. It seems that they just stood around and didn't do anything while the nationalists ended up fighting with the pro-Russia side. And I should say, when I say pro-Russia, I don't mean, you know, Russian identity. I mean pro, like, Russian Federation, that they want to be part of the Russian Federation, which is an entirely separate thing than wanting your own, you know, cultural recognition and everything within Ukraine, which is fair. I mean, that goes to the point that Persephone and I were talking about with Catalonia, et cetera, and these other areas of Europe, that you want to recognize these things.
Right. But they're not just, you know, culturally Russian. They're separatists. They want to leave Ukraine.
Right. So the police just stood around doing nothing because the police is pretty sympathetic to this cause there. Odessa's a, you know, not as heavily Russian as, say, Donetsk, but is relatively Russian. They didn't want to really get involved. And it was also not clear, was this a protest by the Russians that got set upon by the nationalists, or was this the nationalists got set upon by Russian thugs? It's still a little confusing as to what happened. But as far as I've been able to make out the situation, it seems that young Ukrainian nationalists, both from Odessa and visiting to watch the Kharkiv soccer team play, and that region, that oblast is one of the other ones that's been seized by the Russian separatists. So you've got people visiting from there, and instead of fueling the pro-Russian side, they're actually there in support of Ukrainian unity. And the reason for that is because they're younger, and if you really stop and think about it, if you're under the age of 30, you either grew up entirely in Ukraine and not in Russia or the Soviet Union at all, or you're too young to remember the Soviet Union. And if you're under 25, you're definitely in that category. So the younger folks, even in the Russian-speaking areas, even when they speak Russian themselves, have an idea that is of a, you know, sort of more unified Ukrainian identity that is not just ethnically Ukrainian and is not so divisive. And they're not happy about the idea of going into Russia because, as kind of not great as Ukraine is a lot of the times, Russia's certainly not what they're looking to be involved in either. So they staged a parade in favor of national unity. Then these kind of lightly armed thugs showed up from the Russian side. There were gunshots fired into the nationalist crowd. Then the nationalist crowd started picking up bricks and throwing them. There was this huge kind of brawl. Like I said, the police didn't really get involved. Barricades went up. Some of the Russian side barricaded themselves in a government building, perhaps to try to take it over. And then, this is horrible, the nationalist side then set fire to the building, and a lot of people died because of that. Several dozen people were killed as a result of this whole thing. So not a great look on either side, but I think certainly not helped by then the 70 or so Russian speakers or separatist supporters who were detained as part of mass arrests when the police finally did intervene. They were then quote-unquote liberated by an estimated 1,200 Russian separatists who showed up at the detention center to spring them. To me, that sounds like maybe there is another highly organized infiltration in progress, which would help link up this, you know, Donetsk to Odessa area. So that's kind of what we're looking at right now. And again, like Greg said, the situation could change, and maybe we're interpreting it wrong. A Russian gentleman today took issue with my interpretation of events and was arguing with me back and forth on that. I am of the opinion that I am doing a relatively good job of sifting through the various accounts and trying to figure out what actually has happened in these things rather than just taking everything at face value. But he, I think, had maybe bought a little bit too hard into the Russian media's view of events, which doesn't seem to be all that accurate, because sometimes the BBC reporters on the ground have not been able to confirm things that are supposedly happening where they are, according to Russian media. So, you know, that raises some questions there. I think this drumbeat, creating a narrative and a context for war, which is something the U.S. does pretty frequently when it goes to war, but Russia certainly in high gear for several months now, and then before that, before the revolution happened, also saying that these protesters were all fascists or whatever, which I also need some of the American left to chill out about that too, because I don't think it's helpful to be calling these people fascists. Some of them may indeed be fascists on the ground, but to say that this government is an interim government run by fascists is just a patently absurd thing to say, and really disrespectful, I think, to the people who have been killed by fascists in the past. And let's be real, there used to be a strong fascist or semi-fascist, or at least fascist-friendly group operating in Ukraine for a long time on the Ukrainian nationalist side during World War II and after World War II. They were ultimately defeated by infiltration by the Soviet Union and their agents. But I was looking at reports last night summarized on Wikipedia, and apparently, like, in 1946, this group that is, you know, maybe linked to fascism managed to assassinate over 11,000 officials, Soviet officials, in an approximately 2-year span between the Nazi withdrawal and the Soviets, you know, trying to retake control of Ukraine. That's a pretty impressive hit rate, and those people are actual fascists, and they committed actual atrocities, because whether or not it was justified to assassinate these Soviet officials, which that seems a little bit on the excessive side, they also committed out-and-out atrocities and would massacre villages for allegedly ratting them out. So to compare the people who are getting a bit grumpy at breaking some windows during protests, or to say that even the people in the government themselves are fascists, I think that's really disrespectful to the fact that there have been actual fascists in Ukraine who are far, far worse. And we need to recognize who the real fascists have been historically, and then not call people who clearly aren't fascists that, because that's just not okay, in my opinion, anyway.
Right. I mean, not even the boneheads that distributed that letter to all the Jews. I think they're just boneheads more than fascists.
Especially as it seems to have turned out that this was perhaps like a hoax type thing. I mean, right. There were a lot of allegations that this was meant to discredit the separatists or whatever. So their intention was not actually to round up or register Jews, but rather to make the Jewish community believe that that was going to happen.
Right.
Not a great thing either, but, you know, at least that's better than the other alternative. Did you have any other thoughts on this Ukraine situation?
I think we'll just have to keep an eye on it. I mean, you know, it's been just a wealth of things to talk about for probably the past 6 months on this podcast, and 6 months in every single current event conversation that I've gotten in at work. I'd rather that it wasn't, really.
Yeah. I mean, Ukraine going into meltdown has been great for my blog, because people that, you know, have followed me for years, that's the kind of stuff they turn to me for. And it's been great for getting, you know, my hits up or whatever. But yeah, I'd rather us not be on the brink of possibly the most significant land war in Europe since 1945. That's not what I'm looking forward to. But yeah, and I think it is interesting too, and you wanted me to talk about this a little bit, that it seems like Putin is really out there on his own on this. Because I started looking around, you know, usually both in world history and recent history and European history specifically, usually no matter how bad or crazy someone's ideas are or their foreign policy or whatever, they can get somebody to back them up on it. And that's especially true in Europe. You know, think about all the people, all the countries and little principalities and whatever that all aligned against Napoleon and revolutionary France. And they had like 7 coalitions or something before they managed to restore the monarchy there. Even at the height of that, when there were so many of these countries united against France, you still had France managing to either by force or by persuasion convince a number of other countries to back them up, including some fairly major military powers at the time. Similarly, you know, for as horrible as Hitler was, and in retrospect, you know, we have painted this picture of, oh, everyone ganged up on Hitler. I mean, for a while, he was aligned with the Soviet Union. They had an actual military alliance at the beginning of the war, and that didn't break down until he actually invaded the Soviet Union. And even after that, he still had, you know, he was allies with Italy, allies with Axis Romania, allies with Axis Hungary, you know, allies with the Franco regime, even if they weren't militarily getting involved, etc. He had friends and supporters, people who were intellectually willing to say, you know, I back this guy up, which they shouldn't have. That was a mistake. But my point being that in the context of European history, every time somebody goes way out on a limb like this, there are still people who are willing to back them up. We are now seeing a sea change. European Union, NATO, and all the other folks in Europe, if they're not in that, are all very strongly united again. They're not necessarily going to go to war. That's not in anybody's really interest. Even Ukraine's, that's not really in their interest. But they're willing to get out there and say, we're united in opposition to this maneuver by Putin. That's what we're willing to say we're united against. And even Belarus, which is one of the countries that is closest to Russia culturally, I believe that although sort of a Belarusian identity has emerged, if I remember correctly, 80 to 90% of the population still speaks Russian as a first language there. That area, Belarusia, used to be called White Russia in the English translation, because that's what that combination that I just said means, essentially. And it's one of the most sort of Russified areas of the former Russian Empire, even before the Soviet Union. And the current strongman there, Alexander Lukashenko, was elected, if I recall correctly, in about 1994 or so, and he's been in ever since. He was elected explicitly on a platform of, hey, I think this whole independence thing was a bad idea. We should remerge with Russia. Now, he's off and on had kind of falling outs with Russia over various things, mostly involving natural gas. But I think it is noteworthy that this sort of unionist faction in Belarus now publicly saying, we believe that if Ukraine goes down, we are next. I mean, some of the Central Asian former Soviet republics are closer to Russia than Belarus is, you know, in terms of their alignments politically. But if you look in Europe, probably the closest aligned with Russia is Belarus. And even they are not on board with this. I even looked earlier today to see what China was saying about this. China wasn't too happy about the Crimea situation and kind of ignored that or tried to downplay it and whatever. The Chinese government is so uncomfortable by this policy shift, especially because they used to side with Russia solely on this principle of the central state should be able to determine its own affairs. No one should be able to break away. And, you know, there shouldn't be any referendums on independence by any regions and all that kind of good stuff. They used to love Russia for that and back them up on it. And now this is a complete policy reversal from Putin, where he's saying not only are we willing to back separatist movements in other countries, but we're also willing to try to annex by referendum and force other parts of other neighboring countries. And to top it all off, then we're going to go and say, oh, this government in Ukraine is not allowed to use force to, you know, stop separatism within its own borders, even if you accept the Russian claim that they have no troops in eastern Ukraine, right? Then if you look at it on its face, it's just the Ukrainian government responding to a bunch of rebels trying to secede. And that's what Russia used to do itself. So China's point of view is, where did Russia go? This is not the Russia we used to know. So they've been curiously silent for, you know, 3 weeks, I think, now. It was the last statement I could find. So I think Putin's really standing out there on a limb. You know, even at the height of George W. Bush being terrible on foreign policy and making horrible decisions, he had Tony Blair in his camp, and he had, you know, don't forget about Poland. So that's not a great coalition, but it's a coalition, right? Even the U.S., when they almost went into Syria last year or did the bombing thing where they were going to, we had a bigger coalition, not a great one, but a bigger coalition still lined up than Putin has right now. And I think at that point, even if you are, you know, kind of buying into this, you know, these claims by Putin, you got to really think hard about, with no one else is backing you up, doesn't that probably say you shouldn't be doing it? Arsenal for Democracy is going to be coming back in just a second so I can do my segment with Sarah, but I got to let Greg go first. Greg, thank you for being on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you as always.